Iku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuleana imua okea aha ho o kolokolo ki iki hanahano o ko moku aina o hoi. E nai mai, e malio mai, ilohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho ilalo, please be seated.
Belina, makamoku punio o ahu I kamoku o kona e ano ka koma ali o lani hale. Greetings. On the island of Oahu in the district of Kona, we are gathered here at Ali'i o Lani Hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-23-000478, State of Hawaii, Respondent Plaintiff Appellant versus Basil Woody, Petitioner Defendant Appellee. Arguing for Petitioner Basil Woody, Eli Bowman. Arguing for Respondent State of Hawaii, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Matthew Woodward. Argument on the merits.
Mahalo. Aloha kakahiaka. Good morning. I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Judge James Ashford. Thank you for being here. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. Just to confirm, Mr. Bowman, I understand you'll argue for 20 minutes, reserve any remaining time for rebuttal. And Mr. Woodward, you will have 30 minutes with a 5-minute warning. Mr. Bowman, please proceed.
Good morning, Justices. Chief Justice McKenna, thank you very much for your time and consideration in this matter. May it please the court. This case centers around whether the ICA gravely erred when overruling Judge Sokolow's detailed, well-reasoned order denying a state motion to continue for witness unavailability. This motion to continue may...
Mr. Bowman, would you mind raising that microphone?
You see, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. This motion to continue made a mere 48 hours prior to evidentiary hearing must first be viewed with disfavor as a request to continue made very shortly before the day of hearing is generally viewed with disfavor. The standard to evaluate Judge Sokolow's decision is abuse of discretion, a high standard demanding rigorous scrutiny. The order denying the state's motion to continue contains a detailed 10-point finding and states with specificity the judge's rationale behind her finding no good cause to grant the motion. This order, after a thorough colloquy with the prosecutor, notes the state had 54 days of notice for this hearing. The order also notes that no one at the prosecutor's office at any time ever reached out to contact the witness to determine the witness's availability. The prosecutor first spoke with their witness 4 days before hearing because the witness reached out and contacted the state, not the state contacting the witness. Judge Sokolow's detailed order also notes in point 10 a reasonable alternative to continuing the hearing, which would have been available to the state had they acted with any diligence in preparation. This reasonable alternative, point 10, is advancing the hearing, which the state made no effort to do, despite almost...
Counsel, if I may interrupt, and I apologize. Did the court consider any lesser sanctions, lesser options, other than effectively dismissing the case?
So...
And should the judge have considered lesser sanctions?
So first, the judge, thank you for that question. The judge did not dismiss the case. The judge denied the state's motion to continue the hearing.
But that effectively killed the case because he needed the officer to testify on the state side.
It deprived the state the ability to introduce critical evidence at trial, correct? I believe lesser sanctions may have been appropriate had the court had more than 48 hours of notice. These reasonable alternatives, as the judge mentioned.
Well, whether it's 48 hours or the hour before the hearing, couldn't the court still consider lesser sanctions? And should the court have considered lesser sanctions? What's your position on that?
So, again, the 48 hours of notice deprived the court of the ability to exercise lesser sanctions. Lesser sanctions are actually enumerated in U.S. v. Burrell, which is a Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals case, which notes that reasonable alternatives include finding out where the witness's training was located, whether or not the witness could have found time in the schedule to do both.
Well, haven't we said before in cases that, you know, if you subpoena the witness 10 days out, that was considered due diligence, reasonableness? This one, it was 9 days out. Is that what it was on the record? And I couldn't tell, because it seemed the subpoena was issued, whether or not it was served or not. Was there anything in the record indicating when it was served?
So thank you, Anna. And that is a very salient question to this issue. And no, the record is devoid of service.
Is there any representation made on the record as to whether or not it was served? And if so, when?
No.
I didn't see it in the declaration from counsel.
No. There is no indication, there is no evidence that this subpoena was ever served, nor attempted to be served. The only evidence we have on record is the mere issuance of a subpoena. As we know from the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure 17, a subpoena issued is a term of art. A subpoena is issued when it is signed and stamped or sealed by the clerk of court, but otherwise left blank to the party to then be filled out and served. What we have here, Justice, is a representation by the state that the subpoena was merely issued. We have no other facts before us. The record is devoid of whether or not the subpoena was ever filled out.
What prejudice has your client suffered? I mean, you're just basically arguing, delay is harmful. But what concrete prejudice was there to your client here?
Concrete prejudice. Judge Sokolow's decision first to grant and finding no good cause for it, I don't believe discussed prejudice. But as stated in State v. Willeander, State v. Lee, there is prejudice to a party who has prepared.
Those are defense-related continuance cases, aren't they?
Correct. Yes.
Is there a difference between the defense and the right to a fair trial, the right to present a complete defense that's different in that witness context than it is in this context?
Yes, completely.
Are you relying on those cases?
Because the excerpts from them apply in both contexts.
The defense's position that the Lee and the Willeander cases should apply to a state motion to continue?
No.
What do you think the standard should be to address a state motion to continue based on unavailability of a witness?
Although I don't have a complete elements test, I think it is a crucial analysis to the determination of whether to grant or deny a motion to suppress that in element B, due diligence on behalf of the move-on to secure the attendance of their witness.
It's a due diligence based on what? Good cause?
Correct.
Is it a good cause test that you're suggesting we apply, which I believe was applied in Villarimo in terms of a motion to continue a probation hearing? Of course, Rule 48 talks about good cause. In Villarimo, this court discussed Rule 7 of the Rules of the Circuit Courts, which apply a good cause standard for motions to continue trial. Now, this was not a motion to continue trial, but I think what we need to figure out is what test applies to a state motion to continue.
I think the court, the Willander court, was right to note that the test in Lee goes a bit too far in limiting the right to compulsory process, a defendant's right, as a defendant has constitutional rights. The state has obligations. And rather than proposing a test, what defense's argument here is that regardless of what test, what elements and what factors, it must necessarily contain an evaluation of due diligence. And that is what our argument centers on.
Anything in addition to that?
Well, noting that I believe the standard or scrutiny should be higher for a state's motion to continue than a defendant's motion to continue, as a defendant, again, has constitutional rights regarding the process and the state has obligations.
Okay, when you say higher in what way?
Higher in elements.
What elements are we talking about?
The elements in Lee.
We're trying to get a test out of you to see if something that you're proposing or what you think should be used to define good cause or due diligence or abuse of discretion. I mean, we have all these considerations out there. What is it that you want the court to land on?
At the very least, due diligence.
Well, it sounds like you're not answering the question that we say at the very least. Isn't there something more? I hear you basically just saying that lack of due diligence automatically requires a denial of the continuance. And that seems to punish the state for, I mean, let's call it imperfect management of witnesses or, but, you know, we're talking about a constitutional question here on a motion to suppress. Isn't there a public interest in getting that constitutional question correct?
Yes. I would say that is overweighed or outweighed by the state's failure to diligently prepare for that hearing.
So your position is it's due diligence and you don't need to consider anything else. In other words, what if this had been a murder charge? Do we consider the seriousness of the offense? You're basically, it appears that you're arguing that if this had been a murder charge and this the same facts had occurred, no due diligence case, murder charge is dismissed.
If the state showed the level of care, diligence, and preparation in a murder case as they did in this OVUII charge, perhaps that prosecution should not go forward.
So courts should not consider the seriousness of the offense.
Again,
or whether or not denying the motion, the materiality of the witness to the case. In other words, how important is that witness?
The materiality of the witness may absolutely be an element. Again, the Lee test, the Lee test does discuss a defendant's motion to continue trial and therefore slightly differentiable. I would say the elements in the Lee test are not far from what I would consider appropriate in this matter. However, it is a conjunctive test, right, separated by and so all elements of the test must be met. And so, again, defense's argument is regardless of the elements that we want to impose upon the consideration in granting or denying the state's motion to continue, one of those elements in this conjunctive test must be due diligence.
What about the state's argument that there's a preference that, you know, cases be tried on the merits? How do you respond to that?
If the state wanted cases to be decided on the merits, they should diligently prepare for hearing.
Let's say the subpoena was served 9 days out, and the officer calls a few days off from there and says, you know, I've got this military leave. It's just kind of out of the hands of the state's control at that point. State reports it and asks for a motion to continue. What's unreasonable about that, if that was the situation?
In that hypothetical, Justice, if the subpoena was served, it would completely change the analysis. However, Not only in this case do we have no service.
Okay, would it change it in favoring due diligence?
Absolutely, 100%. That is diligence in securing the attendance of your witness for hearing.
Does the record reflect how the officer became aware that he was supposed to appear?
No.
So how can you find a lack of due diligence when we don't have any facts in the record about this? We don't know if it was served or when it was served. We don't have a lot of facts, do we?
Correct. And the dearth of facts on the record support my argument. Defense's argument.
Do they support a finding of a lack of due diligence or simply a finding of inadequate facts to make a determination on due diligence?
I'd argue those splitting those hairs is pretty close. But yes, that is, yes, frankly.
In other words, earlier Justice Devens asked you, he said, don't we have case law that says 10 days service is good enough? So why isn't 9? If the guy was served 9 days before, okay. Was that sufficient?
Yes, okay. 100% absolutely. If a subpoena was served in this matter, it would change this analysis completely on its head. The record being devoid of these facts does not give us cause to fill them in ourselves. Right. It gives us no... The record being devoid of facts is properly considered to deny the motion. I don't know how in a lack or absence of facts we are to assume or suppose action that we don't have evidence of.
Well, who cares if there was a subpoena served or not? I mean, subpoena served, subpoena not served, state's not ready either way. It just seems, again, that you're circling back to just due diligence. But let me switch to another issue. Doesn't Rule 48 provide, a little bit of cover to the state here that, hey, look, we got Rule 48 as a backstop to any significant delays that undermine your client's interest in a speedy resolution of the case?
Yes, and Rule 48 was considered, a defense motion to continue was considered in State v. Hirano, Hawaii case, where in Hirano, having a bit of trouble with this distance and volume with the microphone. In State v. Hirano, the court notes that we recognize, this is a quote directly from State v. Hirano, we recognize that the court could have denied the continuance and subpoenaed the witness or issued a material witness order under HRS Chapter 835 to ensure the attendance at trial. However, we do not deem it an abuse of discretion for the court to reject those alternatives. So, yes, had the witness's unavailability been brought in a timely manner to the court's attention, the court could have fashioned several remedies, including advancing the hearing, which is noted in Judge Sokolow's detailed 10-point finding. They could have seen if there was a way to accommodate the witness's testimony via electronic communication or Zoom. There was no motion for that. And there was no facts on the record to indicate that the witness couldn't have done both his military training and testify.
He was supposed to be in reserve training, right? When military training, how can he appear via Zoom for a hearing?
Yeah, and I'll follow up on what Justice McKenna just said. Absolutely. Are you suggesting that somehow the right to cross a witness in an evidentiary hearing can be conducted over Zoom?
I believe if the defendant consents, that would not be an issue. However, that option was not explored. That option was never presented to the court. That option was not requested. That option actually is given to us in That case again, U.S. v. Burrell. This site is 634F3D284, which notes that the government did not present any evidence that it made reasonable efforts to secure, in this case, its Deputy Crawford's presence. The government repeatedly failed to present any evidence to explain why, through reasonable efforts, transportation could not be arranged to bring its witness to trial.
Okay, but in this case, you know, Mr. Woodward submitted a declaration saying that the officer is unavailable to testify, period, due to his military commitment.
Which is similar in U.S. v. Burrell, which is the prosecutor's claim as well. However, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals noted that the government repeatedly failed to present any evidence to explain why, through reasonable efforts, transportation could not be arranged to bring its witness to court.
Wait, isn't the department actually required under federal law to allow the officer to attend their reserve assignment?
I don't know that, Justice. I apologize. I'm not familiar with that law.
Is there any reason to doubt what the declaration says? It says the officer is unavailable, period. Military assignment. Call out. He's gone. Not Zoom, not anything.
Yes, that was the same situation in U.S. v. Burrell, where the witness was unavailable due to training. However, as we see with that decision, the court undertook a further colloquy, further investigation into it to determine if any reasonable alternatives could have been met. Here, with a mere 48 hours of notice, the judge did not have time to consider reasonable alternatives and did not abuse her discretion in her detailed finding, denying the state's motion.
You refer to the trial setting as sort of like a absolute backstop, like there's no ability to move it. There was time under Rule 48, right, for purposes of rescheduling. Was there any, you know, there's still an opportunity to look at the court's calendar and look at other opportunities to schedule. So it's not just a 48-hour backstop. There's other options that were potentially available, correct? For the court to consider.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the court could have decided differently. Absolutely. There are alternatives. However, we're not here to determine whether Judge Sokolow's decision was right or wrong. We're here to determine.
I disagree with you on that. We are here to determine whether she abused. You started your argument with whether she abused her discretion.
Correct. Abuse of discretion.
In,
not
in
a right
denying
or wrong.
The very first motion to continue the
correct.
Trial.
Correct. Right? This is an abuse of discretion, not right or wrong. And although we may disagree with Judge Sokolow's well-reasoned, detailed 10-point finding, defense argues that it is not an abuse of her discretion when you consider the facts of the state's complete lack of effort in securing the attendance of their witness for trial. We may disagree. We may say that she got it wrong, but we're here on abuse of discretion.
An abuse of discretion has two parts, whether the court clearly exceeded the bounds of reason, or second, whether the court disregarded rules or principles of law or practice to the substantial detriment of a party litigant. So the issue here is whether there were rules or principles of law or practice applicable to this type of situation.
Absolutely.
And that is why we're trying to determine what the standard should be. Right?
Yes, correct. And defense can think of no more highly relevant factor in any test on a state motion to continue than due diligence. And what we have here is a complete lack of due diligence.
You have also agreed that it is a good cause standard. So you seem to be arguing that due diligence is the only issue, only factor to be considered in a good cause analysis.
Pardon me, Your Honor. Pardon me, Chief Justice McKenna. No. The defense doesn't have a strong argument on what elements to be considered. Defense is not defense is not suggesting or putting forth that there's just a one element test. What defense is arguing is that regardless of whatever elements go into that test, and State v. Lee is not, it's not a bad test, it will be.
What do you think the court applied in its finding of good cause? What test did the court apply?
Diligence.
Due
diligence.
Is that it?
So in the court's 10-point finding, the court goes over several, 10 findings. And within those, I think the most relevant...
Was it all related to due diligence, though? And that was the basis of the good cause? Was the court mentions good cause? Yes. Was it all based solely on due diligence?
I can't say if it was based solely on due diligence,
okay,
but
then,
I believe...
Well, what's the additional then, if it's not solely on that?
Pardon me, I missed your question there.
You said it wasn't based solely on due diligence. What were the additional considerations then?
Oh, no, I said I'm not sure. I believe most of the 10-point factors do go and weigh towards due diligence.
Okay, anything outside of that that you think the court considered? It's okay. Why don't you address that when you come up? Because I don't want to chew up all your time.
Oh, wow. We're at 24 minutes. All right. I think at this point I was going to reserve. I do apologize for that. Thank you. It appears most of the 10 points, yes, go straight to due diligence.
Thank you.
All right. Go ahead and reserve your time for rebuttal, Mr. Woodward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justice. Good morning to esteemed counsel and my colleague, Mr. Eli Bowman. May it please the court. My name is Matt Woodward. I have the privilege and opportunity to represent the people, the county, and state of Hawaii in criminal matters. And today, the state will be the first one to admit this case requires us to have a conversation that none of us want to have. And that conversation is about discretion. Because in each and our respective positions, we all enjoy discretion. It's one of the few ways that the system can actually work. And while esteemed counsel couches this case as an attempted constraint on judicial discretion, it is simply not. The court had numerous options that it could have availed itself of if it was simply unhappy with the time that it took for the state to secure a witness and subpoena them and then file for a continuance. Court could have dismissed the case right then and there, could have entered into a modified extension analysis and said, hey, how many times has the defendant been to court? What's the impact of re-prosecution? What's the seriousness of the charge? Court could have dismissed it without prejudice as well. Court could also have taken the motion and said, well, you know what? The state's not ready to go. All right, I'm going to nunk-pro-tunk this back to the time when the defense filed their motion to continue, and the state can eat the Rule 48 time until the next continuance. Court also could have granted the motion to suppress without prejudice, and at trial, been able to go through a opportunity for the defense counsel to object on a probable cause basis, because this would have been a bench trial. Right? And that could have actually happened. Could have sanctioned the attorney. Could have said, you know what, Mr. Prosecutor, you are not ready to go. Get the checkbook out. Or, hey, the court has had 2 hours set aside for this hearing. You have wasted the court's time. Go sit in the sheriff's locker for 2 hours and see how you like it. There are numerous options this court employed, but there was only one that was beyond the scope of that discretion, and that was granting the motion to suppress. Because while we say, you know, a dismissal is sort of the nuclear option, this was a thermonuclear option. This case was done. Even the identity of the defendant was suppressed, all right, on granting that motion. There is no case. All right, so the state at no point was able to present evidence or have any evidentiary hearing on this particular matter. And that is part of the reason here that we're really talking not so much about due diligence, not so much about procuring witnesses. Whether they're there or not, and the state asks for continuance, the court has a lot of options, right? can be those sanctions, can be that dismissal, can be charging that Rule 48 time to the state. Those are all things that are available to the court. What the court cannot do is unfortunately what the court did. And this is a situation, and quite frankly, I don't disagree with Mr. Bowman.
Well, how does it exceed the bounds of reason when, you know, you're told about the hearing back in April? Nothing seems to be done until 9 days out. There's a subpoena issued. Whether it was served or not is still up in the air. We don't have any record on that. 4 days out, you're notified the officer is not available, and then 2 days out, you file for the continuance. Why is that an abuse of discretion? The court looked at it and said, I got to move my calendar. Waited all that time. Why is that an abuse?
I don't disagree with you one bit. But the issue is the abuse comes in with the remedy that the court decided. Because basically, that's the end of the case there. I mean, the court could have dismissed this case and could have gone.
It could have, but it chose not to. Why is that an abuse? The court looked at everything and said, look, you waited too long. I got a calendar. I got a defendant that showed up. And you come in here 2 days before the hearing and tell me you want to continue. And the court said no.
But in saying no, the court granted that motion without hearing any evidence whatsoever. So really the difference is the court could dismiss the case, but by granting the motion to suppress, you're basically saying you can't even identify the defendant in court.
Well, the court was willing to hear evidence. You just didn't have evidence available. That's on you, isn't it?
Well, based on how the motion was decided, yes. I mean, we had no case at that point.
And you had a full and fair opportunity to present evidence.
We had one opportunity, and that was the first time.
How many do you need?
I'm sorry?
How many do you need? It was set in advance. That was your opportunity. You didn't have your witness available.
That is a very fair point. But I think the issue is, and now this is a tougher question because we have to talk about how things are theoretically practiced versus how they actually are, especially in a district court scenario. You are cranking these cases, and sometimes you do not get these cases until 2 or 3 days before the surgical trial. And that's not an excuse on behalf of the state. All right, but these motions to continue are sometimes granted on the day of trial, quite regularly. And it certainly is up to the judge whether or not
you had from April to let the witness know, the officer, that we got this June hearing. And these military assignments, they don't just come up 2 days before the call-out. Right? These reservists are told in advance, a year in advance.
Right.
You got summer camp coming up. It's not a surprise.
No, that's absolutely correct.
So isn't that a lack of due diligence on the state's part?
I don't
not getting that information and letting the officer know back in April when the hearing was set. Let them know that day.
Justice, you'll get no argument from me on that point. You're absolutely right. It does show a lack.
All right.
The remedy, however, is really what I believe the issue of this particular case is about. That is really the heart of it, because dismissing the case is one thing, granting this motion is another, because as I said, this is the thermonuclear option. Like, there is no case.
So is that part of the test that you're advocating for, that that's a consideration?
I
lesser
think
sanctions?
Possibly. Yes, I absolutely, I do, and I think that that's sort of, I mentioned that sort of a modified abstention analysis, where the court could say, how many times has the state asked to continue this thing? How many times has the defendant shown up here and we haven't gone? You know, what is the severity of that crime? What is the impact of that re-prosecution? How long has it been? How close are we to Rule 48? You know, hey, guess what? Your Rule 48 runtime is October. Tough break. Court doesn't have any time till November, so you'll have to live with that.
So are you saying the court should look at the totality of the circumstances in deciding good cause?
I do. I do think it should look at the totality of the circumstances, especially with regards to, I think we're having a different conversation if this is the fifth time the state shows up and said, oh, sorry, I don't have my witness.
All right.
Now, even if the court had granted the motion to suppress then, I still would disagree with it. But even if the court had decided to dismiss this case with prejudice on that day, the state would not have liked it, but I would not have the privilege of standing here arguing this case before you today. Because I do think that is within the judge's discretion. They could have gone through that modified abstention analysis and said, you know what, this is an OVUII case. All right. The impact of re-prosecution, it's a petty misdemeanor. The court is jammed up. We don't have time for this. All right. I'm dismissing it without prejudice, or just dismissing it with prejudice. Right. And that would have been fine. We wouldn't have been happy, but we would not be here arguing what we're arguing about today. Because the point of this particular case has to do with granting that motion to suppress, where now you have nothing more than a fait accompli of a trial, because there's no evidence to present. You're not even able to identify the defendant or talk about why they were even stopped in that particular case.
Mr. Woodward, Mr. Bowman advocated for different tests, depending on whether it was the state moving for a motion for a continuance versus a defendant in a criminal matter. I'd like you to address that.
Right. Well, and absolutely, it should be a different test. Because while, you know, I advocate for the state, part of the concern being a prosecutor is you also have to protect the defendant's rights. That's important as well. And there should be two different tests. And if you look at the test in Willeander, it's sort of analogous to what happened in this case, and I can explain why. Because in Willeander, when they went for the motion to continue and it was denied, what the court basically said was, guess what? Your motion to continue is denied, and you're going to be found guilty. Because Willeander only had one witness, and that was him. He did not have the officer that particular day.
So you're asserting a totality of the circumstances test for purposes of this case. How would a case involving a defendant be different?
Well, is there a manifest injustice to the defendant not being able to proceed with trial? And in Willeander, there obviously was. This was the only witness that could potentially give him some sort of credibility or talk about his potential state of mind when this incident happened. The defendant is always going to get the benefit of the doubt. Quite frankly, the defendant is going to be able to continue the case in perpetuity, I mean, obviously within reason, because the defendant's rights are much more important in that scenario. But what happened in Willeander, as I said, it was kind of similar here, because the court in this case basically said, hey, you're not getting your motion to continue, and your case is also over, much like the court did in Willeander. And that's sort of the analog here. But the defendant is always going to get the benefit of that doubt. If witnesses are unavailable on the day of trial, and that is a key critical witness, then either that case is going to get continued, or that defendant's rights are going to be violated, right? Because if that witness cannot appear and testify for them, that is a manifest injustice, right? And that can't happen. And courts would be well within their discretion, you know, to continue that case, regardless of whether the state would object or not. Quite frankly, if I was in that position, I probably would not object, because the defense rights are that important, right? So I'm not advocating that somehow the state and the defense, you know, are on equal footing when it comes to requesting continuances. And that's why I am suggesting that the court does have those lesser options to address other than granting this motion to suppress. That dismissal, sanctioning that attorney, non-protunking the filing and charging the Rule 48 time to the state. Those are all options that the court has. But this one was slightly a bridge too far. And if you read the transcript, even my esteemed colleague, Mr. Bowman, didn't ask for the motion to suppress to be granted. He asked for the case to be dismissed with prejudice. Even he thought that was a bridge too far. And I think we're really talking about the same sort of issues here, in the understanding that this is an abuse of the court's discretion.
Do you think that there should, Rule 48 mentions good cause, but Rule 7 of the Rules of Circuit Court also mentions good cause. Our case law mentions good cause. Do you think that, and we have actually provided a more stringent test for good cause in the Rule 48 context, which allows time to be excluded. Do you think that that test applies, or do you think that a general standard of good cause applies here, where we're not discussing whether or not time should be excluded, or should the exclusion of time test of good cause under Rule 48 apply here also to the state?
For the state?
Yes.
To have the time told while it procures its witness and answer the condition? No, that should count against the state. All right, and I believe that is the purpose of Rule 48. If you know, Mr. Bowman is correct, you know, if the state is not you know, diligent enough in securing its witnesses, it can't then show up and be like, hey, I need more time. That clock is running, and there's only certain excludable periods. All right, and that's why the court also could have looked back and said, hey, Mr. Bowman filed his motion on February 14th. Now we're in the middle of April. I'm charging you for that time. An old saying that says sometimes you can get to the right result for all the wrong reasons. This is a situation where we got to the wrong result for all the right ones. As I said before, Mr. Bowman's not wrong, right? There was a lack of due diligence here on behalf of the state. The remedy, however, is the problem. Because if we change the facts slightly in Willeander, and the defendant said, I don't have any witnesses, the court couldn't have said, well, tough break, you're not getting the continuance, and you're guilty. You can't do that, right? And the same thing with the state. If the state showed up for trial and said, oh, my witnesses are not ready to go, the court could not say, okay, sua sponte, judgment of acquittal for the defendant. The court would dismiss the case. Right? But that's kind of the analog here. By granting that motion to suppress, that's what actually happened. Because this case, as I said before, was over. Right? There was nothing left for the state to prosecute.
You know, what's the real difference, though? If I thought I heard you say that, you know, if it was set for trial and the state in a similar situation had their witness unavailable, wasn't able to proceed, that the court, in its discretion, could dismiss the case with prejudice. What's the big difference between essentially doing the same thing with the motion to suppress?
Because one is based on the court's analysis of the prior procedural posture of the case, and the other one is based on, but quite frankly, a fit of pique, like with no evidence whatsoever to support it. To say we can dismiss the case with prejudice, the court can analyze and say, how many continuances have been asked for? What's the impact of re-prosecution? How long has this case been ongoing? Okay, how many times has the defendant been dragged to court? Those sorts of things. Those are all on the record. Those can all be analyzed. But by granting the motion to suppress, you're basically saying, oh, you know, it's a warrantless arrest. It's presumptively unreasonable. Haven't heard any evidence, so I'm granting it. Right. With no other analysis of why or what or when. Like, and even in the findings of fact and conclusion of law from this particular case, like everything was suppressed. But we don't have any basis why. We didn't hear any.
So does that sort of tie in with the question that I asked Mr. Bowman about the public's interest and sort of an independent evaluation of an alleged constitutional violation, which really is what a motion to suppress is?
That's correct. And in terms of that, and the state does have a right to present evidence. And even the court could have gone back and looked at the motions in this case, which I believe are part of the record. The motion that was filed to suppress is pretty much your standard check-the-box warrantless arrest. And the state does respond with numerous facts in that particular motion. And the court could have looked at that and said, you know what, I'm going to change a little bit. I'm actually going to give the deference to the moving party in this particular case. I'm not buying what the state is saying here in their motion, so I'm not going to grant you the continuance.
When was trial in this case scheduled? Was it almost oftentimes in district court, the suppression hearing will be scheduled the same time as trial. You'll just do the suppression hearing. That's ruled upon. We move straight into trial. And that's, you know, for efficiency reasons. If that was the situation, does your analogy or your position, rather, between splicing and dicing suppression hearings and trial itself, is that shaped in a different way?
I think the analysis remains the same, because if you don't have your witness for the suppression hearing, maybe there are other witnesses that could testify at trial. Maybe this particular witness is necessary for the particular suppression issue, whatever it might be. But if that witness isn't available, then that's gonna go against the state as well by not making it. So the court could dismiss the case.
Does the record reflect here whether or not a trial date had been set?
I do not believe it does, and from my memory, I do not believe one had been set. I may be mistaken, though.
What would be your position if the state said, well, I'm just not going to resolve the suppression hearing. We might, and you suggested, wait towards the trial, but then the trial is then held the same day, or maybe just 2 days later with your officer still in training and they're unable to proceed to the trial. Wouldn't you also have the same result of a dismissal?
I think you would. I think that's certainly possible when the court does that analysis to decide whether it should be dismissed with or without prejudice at that time. But what the court wouldn't do is acquit the defendant, which is kind of the analog of what happened here by granting this motion. The case is done. So I think the analysis wouldn't be that different whether it's the same day as the trial or whether the suppression hearing was set a month before. The analysis is still the same. The state's only going to get one or two bites at the apple at most. Right? The defendant's going to get a lot more. Right? But here, this was the state's first bite at the apple. And because of that, there was no case left.
You know, I didn't see any argument on this basis, but following up on what Justice Devens was asking, are there any implications based on the Sailor and Soldiers Relief Act in this case?
I believe in federal law does require military leave to be granted, even to sworn law enforcement officers who are on active duty. So the officer in this case did not have a choice. He had to go to military duty. So yes, I believe it does.
But that act actually applies to civil proceedings, right? It's like civil proceedings need to be delayed. if a witness or a defendant is a soldier. Anyway, right. But there are no arguments on that basis. Right.
No, that law is far beyond the scope of any knowledge I might have. So,
okay.
But I know they are required to give the leave. I'm not sure about the criminal implications for that when they're a witness or a defendant.
You know, let me ask you this. You know, the ICA basically said that, well, you know, we look at Lee, we, you know, think that there was due diligence. Looking at this record, listening to your arguments, can you support the fact that there was due diligence? Was there really due diligence in this case?
Well, Justice, I'm not going to make many friends back at the office here. No, I cannot. And nor would I stand here and pretend to. Right? And I don't think that's really the issue, because as I said, and Mr. Bowman won't get offended, we've been dancing this dance for a number of years, numerous courtrooms, so he won't get mad. It pains me to say this. He's right. He's right. All right. But the problem is here, it's the remedy. The problem here is that thermonuclear option that I talked about, right? So I'm not going to stand here and pretend for a second that there was diligence done over 54 days when a subpoena should have been served and the officer knew well in advance that he was likely going to.
You know, one alternative you suggested was, and it seems creative, you know, you get going in trial and the court at the trial itself sort of decides whether there was probable cause or suppression. You suggested that, right? But doesn't that conflict with the fact that motions to suppress have to be heard and determined before trial?
They do, and I think that would probably maybe fall further into your situation or your analysis, where that suppression hearing would take place right before trial. And you know, during a trial, I think a jury trial would be significantly different. I think a bench trial, which is what would have happened here, that actually could have been done, because judges are going to be presumed to exclude evidence that should not be coming in.
I think we have pretty clear case law. Please read State versus Chang. You cannot combine a motion to suppress with a trial.
Then it would have to go before the trial.
Yes.
Right. And
I'm sorry if I can ask you, counsel, but was there any indication in the record as to whether or not the officer was actually served with the issued subpoena?
Not to my knowledge. I know that he did contact the office to say he was going to be unavailable about 4 days before, but I do not know if he was actually served with that subpoena.
And you don't know what the practice is of your office as to how officers are subpoenaed and or notified as of regarding their appearance dates?
I do now, and we certainly have improved those procedures to avoid this very situation from happening again. Right. So steps were taken, and we do confirm, and we do call well in advance of these hearings. And this is 2023. You know, not to complain. You know, we're understaffed. We're very short. We're coming out of COVID. You know, things are a bit of a mess. All right, and that's not excuse, but still.
You have argued that the court should possibly consider extension factors, which would include the seriousness of the offense. Is it your argument that highly intoxicated OVUII is a serious offense?
I would argue that it is, and having a vast amount of experience with it, people die, and they die with frightening regularity because of highly intoxicated and impaired drivers. And I've been through extension or Rule 48 speedy trial dismissals where the court has found those factors as an OVUII being a serious crime, being one that the legislature, while still deeming it a petty misdemeanor, has significantly higher penalties, including license suspension, the fines, substance abuse assessment, those sorts of things. So clearly the legislature has envisioned that this is a serious crime and one that should be considered in any sort of dismissal or analysis.
What was the blow on this one, 0.15? Is that what it was?
I believe it was a high intox. I might have been a 0.13. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Well, it's not as serious of offense to merit a jury trial, is it?
It is not. And that's I will save my opinions for that. But
you would seem to be protecting the defendant's rights by suggesting there should be a jury trial. But that being said, let me ask you this: is Mr. Bowman suggested that? That the seriousness of the offense was virtually the same on a murder trial as this type of case. What's your position there?
I don't think the analysis would change. What you know, even if it was a murder trial and the court could go through the analysis, and let's say the court was going to be really, really hard on the state and actually dismiss this, there would at least be some basis for finding as such, as opposed to saying, well, the defendant's acquitted. Right? Courts can't do that. Right? But that's actually kind of what happened here.
Chop out the motion to suppress. What if there was just a continuance request absent the motion to suppress on a murder trial?
I think that requires an analysis of how many times have we been here before. Like, how long has it taken to prosecute this particular case? How long did it take to charge it? How many continuances has the state asked for? How many other motions have there been in this particular case? I think if this is the first day of trial and everything has moved along well within Rule 48 time and the state would ask for that continuance, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect the court to grant that continuance. Let's go through that analysis.
And you understand the reason why I think we've posed these questions with, you know, a murder case versus an OVUI, because we're looking at crafting a rule that applies to every situation. I mean, it's hard to splice and dice these things, and I think that's why the seriousness of the offense, you know, has come into a possible framework here. Do you have any suggestions or ideas about how the court could craft or what the court should say good cause is? I mean, it's got to abuse of discretion, in other words, has to anchor to something.
I think the discretion should be very broad, and that's actually what we're kind of asking the court to do here today, is we're not looking to constrain the discretion. We're actually just looking to set a guardrail, a very wide one, a very wide boundary because of that particular discretion. And to your point, Justice, I think the seriousness offense certainly could be crafted around something like even everything from impaired driving to murder. These are particular crimes that can hurt people. Are property crimes going to be analyzed a little bit different under the seriousness offense analysis? Probably. Is the shoplifting case going to warrant, you know, the same sort of scrutiny that the murder case is going to? No, but I do think the analysis regarding the prior procedural history of the case is the most important one in crafting that rule. Like, how many times have we been here? How many continuances have been asked for? Right? How many witnesses have already been called? How many motions have we been through on this particular issue? So I think those are all things that should be considered when you're doing that.
On your initial appeal, what relief, on your initial appeal of the court's grant of the denial of your motion to continue, what relief were you seeking? You're conceding that there was no due diligence, so were you seeking for the court to apply different standards to determine whether or not there should have been lesser sanctions? Or what was it that you were seeking on your initial appeal?
Our basis was to have the motion to suppress overturned, right, and have the case sent back for that actual evidentiary hearing.
To actually have the evidentiary hearing.
Yes, to actually have that hearing, correct. And even if the ICA had come back and said, hey, we're going to do that, but guess what? We still think this is a situation where the state didn't do enough due diligence. This is an impaired driving case. The defendant's been to court 3 times already. We're going to send it back, but we're going to say the case is dismissed. Right? I think that actually would have been fair. I think that is within judicial discretion. So my boundary is very wide. And that's why I'm encouraging the court to sort of understand this as not a constraint, but the guardrail, that safety net that we do need when things like this happen.
So you disagree with the ICA's finding that the state acted with due diligence?
I am the worst at this. I'm never going to be invited back, I'll tell you. But I do. I do, actually. I don't think we did due diligence there. And I think that ruling, and this is one that favors the state, so I probably should not say this, but I do disagree with it. Right? My disagreement is with the remedy that the court applied, not the lack of due diligence on the state.
I appreciate your candidness, counsel.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. It's been an honor to be here.
Thank you. Any rebuttal, Mr. Bowman?
Yes. Thank you, Chief Justice. Just very briefly. State concedes a lack of due diligence here. The question before the court, one of the questions is, did the ICA gravely err in finding due diligence? It appears as if both parties here today agree that the ICA erred in finding due diligence. Next, if the ICA's decision is upheld, this would have deleterious effects on the litigation process. It would encourage litigants to not serve subpoenas. It would encourage litigants to wait until 48 hours to file motions to continue. Based on the evidence that they spoke to their witness, it would be robbing the district court judges of their discretion to deny these these motions. The issue is a motion to continue based on witness unavailability. The state concedes, defense argues, everyone is in agreement here. There was a lack of due diligence in securing that attendance. The district court judge, after a detailed finding, finds no good cause. Again, we may disagree with whether she was right or wrong in her considerations, but this is regarding abuse of discretion. And if discretion in this denying a motion to continue is taken from the district court, this will essentially rob their discretion to deny motions to continue based on witness unavailability in this specific context. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? There being none. E kau pauna ka aha o kolokolo ina mea pili I keia hihia. The court will take this matter under advisement. Mahalo.
E ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne keia aha ho'okolokolo ki iki hanohano o ka moku'aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.